Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of elite mountain biking. We've got something a little bit different for you in this episode. We're going to have a Trans-Provence special. So a good friend of the podcast, Jonathan Matthews, took part in the Trans-Provence a couple of weeks ago, and we found some time with him at the end of last week to talk about how he got into the race, how he prepared for the race, and the race itself. We talked for about an hour, so we've split it up into two parts. This is the first part where we're going to talk about entry to the race and preparation for the race. And then the second part will come out tomorrow and we'll talk all about the race itself. Now, Jonathan is one of the smartest people that I know, and he really does research and analyse everything that he does. He used to race Pro Elite Downhill back in the 90s. He's had a bit of a break from racing, but the Trans-Provence got him fired up and off he went. Now, he doesn't mess around. He really looks into everything that he's going to do. So there's some really, really in-depth stuff in here, some really detailed work in his preparation and his racing. We've tried to put in as many links as we can to the various bits and pieces that Jonathan mentions. So if you head over to our website, downtimepodcast.com, then you should find the information in the show notes. Okay, well, we really hope you like this. It's a little bit different for us. Please let us know. You can find us on social media. We're Downtime Podcast on Instagram, The Downtime Podcast on Facebook, and Downtime Tweets on Twitter. Okay, without further ado, here's the first part of the Trans-Provence special with Jonathan Matthews. Jonathan Matthews, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for coming on.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Cool. So we go back quite a long way. I know you fairly well, but I recognise the fact that most people probably won't have heard of you. Can you just give us a bit of a background on, you know, your riding and what you've done in the past?
Okay, so I feel as if I've been on two wheels for as long as I can remember. I think I probably seriously started mountain biking when I moved up to Wales at the age of about 12, so probably a couple of years after that. And then where we happened to be living was just kind of ideal. So, you know, we just spend more and more time on bikes after school, at weekends. That slowly progressed into I ended up doing a few races, scouring MBUK back in the day, looking for races. And I think my first race was a dual descender at Rivington Pike, which was the rockiest thing that I'd ever come across at the time. And I was on a hardtail, and it was pretty eye opening. And it was the first time I saw Steve Peat and Will Longdon at a race, and it was great. And it was kind of sparked an interest in racing, which then led to me doing competing as a junior in 1995, and then in 1996, and then I moved up to senior 1997, elite in 1998. An elite in 1999, and then I kind of stopped racing in 1999. Managed to get myself to a couple of World Cups in 1998. I feel as if I've, you know, kind of know how to race, but obviously it's been quite a while since I done it with any serious intent.
So what was it that made you stop racing back in 1999 then?
Just kind of fell out of love with it, be honest. It was the tracks weren't the standard that they are today, and it kind of felt like you were just chasing points, either to, you know, to maintain your elite status or to get to World Cups. And you know, you're traveling all over the country, and you might be one weekend at a fantastic venue like Peebles, or, you know, then you'd be doing what was used to be called the SAMS, which was the Southern Area Series, and you'd be racing around a field for all intents and purposes. I just stopped enjoying it, and I've always followed my gut on what I've wanted to do in life. And as soon as I stopped enjoying it, I thought, right, I can move on, do something else.
So did you ever stop riding, or did that continue to be a passion in the background?
I stopped riding for 18 months. I stopped riding a bicycle for 18 months once I stopped, and I did other things. I raced a little bit of amateur motocross, and then through friends at uni, such as yourself, got a hardtail and rode a hardtail and messed around for years after that, really. So, and then it's always been a, you know, always been a large part of my life, wherever I happen to have been.
You made a racing comeback a couple of years ago at Steve Pete's Steel City Downhill up in Sheffield. What was it that kind of triggered you to dust off the racing boots and get back on that?
Trying to think what the actual reason. I think I just fancied doing a race. I'd done an enduro, or what they called it, a sprint enduro, like maybe a year or so before that, and it was awful. It was a mutual friend of ours said, you know, this event was happening, and I think it was up at Andover, which is a great venue for, you know, a relatively small hill, but there's lots of tracks there, and we, you know, the idea of it sounded great, and it was you know, lots of about six tracks off the same hill, and I was like, wow, this is going to be great. We turned up and we maybe rode half the good tracks. There was a like a cross country stage, there was an uphill stage, and the transitions were really short, so it was just awful, not fun at all. But then I think I fancied doing another race, and you know, our other mutual friend Sky of Cossack Cycles, you know, said that he could perhaps get us a place. So I thought, you know, it sounded like a lot of fun. Everyone had said how much fun it was, so I was like, oh, let's have a crack and see how we go. First downhill race in over a decade, I think, or something like that. 15 years.
Yeah. So me and Si are obviously relatively local, and we'd had the opportunity to have some additional practice, shall we say, compared to some of the races. And I think it's fair to say we thought we had the best chance ever of teaching you a lesson. And that didn't happen. You showed up and won the Masters category and beat the guy that won the race. Talk us through a little bit your approach to come into that race and putting in a result like that.
So I spent a little bit of time on my bike to make sure I was, kind of knew what I was doing, and, you know, I'd kind of stay reasonably fit. So, that wasn't really a concern going into it. And I knew full well that it's a, you know, the track is kind of relatively smooth, which is similar to the riding that I do locally down here in the south of England. So I did a bit of, you know, riding as though I was racing, which for me entails kind of a certain level of perceived effort, and, you know, almost moving yourself to that uncomfortable level when you're riding, so that you're, you're not finding it easy. It's slightly more uncomfortable, be that the level of exertion or the pace that you happen to be riding at. And then on the day, it was just really, you know, the volume of people there meant that I think I only got three practice runs, but I think that was sufficient. And then it's really just a case of putting a race run together, which I think, you know, given the racing that I've done, it would be a long time ago, I kind of knew how to do, you know, get your head in the right place, get into that mindset where you're going to put down as close to a, not perfect run, but the limit of what you are able to do on a track. And then just a case of just executing, really.
So how did that feel when you started to push yourself kind of to the limits again? Did it reignite a flame in you? Did it make you want to do a bit more?
Yeah, it did. It did. It was, I think for me, it's like a part of my riding that I don't access very often, because you don't need to. And it was, yeah, it was fun. The course isn't overly challenging, so it's more a case of not making mistakes and carrying momentum. And after that, I toyed with maybe doing a bit more racing, but, it wasn't enough to be like, right, yeah, I'm going to go racing again. It was more a case of, you know, I enjoyed the fun aspect of it. But it maybe wasn't enough for me to be like, right, yeah, I want to do the national series or anything like that. I've got no illusions of grandeur in that sense.
So what led you to putting in an application for Trans-Provence then? How do we get from a Steel City win 2 years ago to Trans-Provence?
I'd see every year that they'd been producing videos, I'd watch the videos avidly every year. And the atmosphere looked amazing. The terrain looked amazing. Like how much fun people were having and the challenge. And I was just, you know, I was just kind of, you know, pretty keen. I've always been keen to give it a go. And I thought, well, you know what? You know, the longer I procrastinate on this, the longer it is until I do it. So I thought, right, it wasn't even this year I'll give it a go. It was, I will enter for the next 5 years and hopefully one of those years I'll actually get a place. So I spoke to my wife and said, look, this is something I'd really like to do, but it will take a bit of commitment because I'll probably have to do a fair bit of training for it. And it will be a week of me kind of not being here. So, you know, she was on board, and so I entered and then kind of forgot about it for a bit. And then 10 days later, I had an email in my inbox. Congratulations, you know, you've got a place on the 2017 Trans-Provence. So kind of sheepishly went into the kitchen and started chatting with my wife and said, oh, you know that race that I said I was going to enter? She was like, oh, you've got a bloody place, haven't you? I was like, yes. That was the start of it, really.
So how does the application side of things work then? Is it literally just a kind of random chance, or do you have to give some information about yourself and your riding?
You have to give some information about your background, like what, the questions are kind of open-ended. It's, you know, part of it, what, you know, a simple question is what bike do you plan to ride? What's your riding experience? So it's an opportunity for you to say like where you've ridden, you know. And I think one of the questions was, you know, you can be in quite hazardous terrain. You know, how would you cope with you know something going wrong in that kind of environment? And I think they're looking for you know an insight into how you're going to do it as you know as a bit of a filtering process. You know, if you kind of say that you're going to do it on a fully rigid bike that you got down at Halfords, no offense to anybody with that bike, but they probably think maybe this guy doesn't really have the you know the background that's suitable, because it's they're long days, the riding is very, very challenging, and it's a tough event.
Okay, so where were we in the year when you got the application accepted? How long ago was that?
November last year.
Okay, so you get plenty of notice. So the race was middle of June.
Yeah, that's right.
So you've got, what's that, seven or 8 months worth of time to think about what you've done and do something about it. Talk us through your approach. So it's November, you found out you've got a place. How do you start putting together everything you need for an event like Trans-Provence?
So at that point, it's the training that, you know, was not the biggest hurdle, but I was aware that I needed to get a plan in place. So I tentatively, you know, started doing a bit of cycling, the road bike.
Good start.
And, you know, I've toyed around with training, in kind of various different disciplines over the years. And, I feel as if I've got to the point that I know what I don't know. And at that point, I decided that I could quite easily put a program together for myself, but the probability of me getting that wrong was high enough that it wasn't worth the gamble. So I contacted Ben Plenge, I think one of your former guests, to help me with the programming side of things. Which was put, and I think that training with him started in earnest, like maybe the beginning ish of December. The reason I think, you know, in hindsight now, the kind of the best thing that came out of that was I would have probably done too much. I wouldn't have taken recovery weeks or You know, it was cycled through from like a hard week to a medium to an easy week and various other things. He left the strength side of things to my, for me to figure out myself at my own request. And then he was responsible for like when I did the strength training in and around the cycling air portion and what those cycling elements look like, be those, you know, rides on the road bike, intervals, mountain biking, hiker biking, and then we'd catch up at the end of every block, which was either 6 weeks or 8 weeks, and have a chat about how things had gone, and then he'd update the program based on my progress.
Okay. I'm guessing there's no such thing as an average or a normal week in a training program, but can you give you know, a bit of an example of what a week might look like? What sort of sessions would it contain and the duration of the and content of those sessions?
Sure. So handily, I can look at an app that he had me using, which was called Training Peaks, which is in essence, it's a fancy calendar for but he can see it and I can see it. It links in with your Garmin or Strava, and it records your workouts. It also provides a monitor, like a noddy monitor of your fitness and your fatigue, the amount of hours you've done, and you know, various other things like that. So, so for instance, here, let's have a hard training week. So Mondays would typically be off, would be a rest day. So the Tuesday would be a home strength workout, 45 minutes. And that day I also did some stretching in the evening. The Wednesday was a endurance ride for roughly 2 hours.
So when you say endurance ride, what would a ride like that look like?
That's kind of riding to, so I used a power meter, so that was riding to my functional threshold power on climbs in either a high zone to a low zone three. So that's to put that in terms of, that's kind of equivalent to the maybe zone three, zone four heart rate, zone five for climbs.
Okay, so working pretty hard then.
Working pretty hard, but I think, you know, able to maintain a conversation, albeit not quite fluidly.
Yeah.
So a good amount of effort done. Mm-hmm. The Thursday was some sprint endurance on a turbo trainer.
So again, what would a session like that look like?
That was 15-second sprint. So a warm-up for 15 minutes, 15-second sprint, 2 minutes recovery, 20-second sprint, 3 minutes recovery, 30-second sprint, 5 minutes recovery, and then you repeat that three times and a cool-down at the end.
And and those sprints are all-out efforts, like as hard as you can go, I guess?
Yeah. Kind of, you know, vomit-inducing, you know, and... If you're not getting to that feeling of wanting to vomit, you're probably not going hard enough. But it's a short session, and you know, after an hour, you're done, and it's quite easy to fit in and around, you know, the rest of your life. On the Friday, I did an hour of strength training, and then at the weekend, I did what it was Ben calls a mixed MTB qualities ride. So went out. Did a 3 hour ride and in that I incorporated a 5 second sprint from standing start, a 10 second sprint from standing start, 20 second sprint from standing start, and then a couple of other like mixed bag sprints and efforts just to kind of, you know, mimic the type of riding that you might be doing on a, you know, either an enduro or something like that. And then on the Sunday, there was just an easy spin with some micro sprints, which are where you just you do an all out for one or two strokes of the of the pedal.
Okay, so just winding up almost.
Yeah, so imagine, you know, coming out of a corner and it's just enough to get you back up to speed.
Yeah.
So it doesn't put a great deal of toll on the on any of your system, your aerobic or anaerobic systems, but it gives it, you know, you're putting strain on the muscles just to kind of maintain that momentum.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a hard week. So there was, you know, quite a lot in there, but, you know, and that was towards, that was the end of March. So, you know, that was the higher end of volume and hours, and the lower end would maybe have just been an hour a day.
Yeah. But even then, still not a huge amount of hours. I mean, tough to fit in around normal life, but not ridiculous.
No. So, you know, I think key is waking up early and doing things before the family wakes up for me. And then, you know, the harder thing with having a family is getting out and doing things at the weekend. But it's, you know, so long as you're prepared to wake up early or do things in the evening, then you can fit this in. It's, you know, the key here for me was the consistency. It's not about showing up and, you know, knocking a session out of the park. It's about, you know, turning up and doing something every day. And, you know, that's what really paid dividends, because I think Ben had me doing a couple of what he called max mileage weeks, where you would, you'd aim to be riding every day and two sessions, either, you know, an endurance ride of 2 hours and then an interval session, or a really long ride, or two interval sessions, as well as 2 3-hour mountain bike rides at the weekend. So I think I did one of those at the end of April, and it was, I think about 320 kilometers in a week. And I was expecting to be pretty blitzed at the end of it, but I ended the week feeling tired, but really good. And I was like, right, this training is on point. I'm doing the right thing. I feel really good. And I was moving great at the end of the week. And it was, you know, it was a real kind of, not only boost for the confidence, but kind of a boost to the fitness, because I felt like my fitness kind of knocked up to a higher level doing that volume of riding.
Interesting. And you, you talked about your strength sessions and the fact that you program those yourselves. What kind of, you know, were there some key elements within those strength sessions that are like go-to exercises for you?
So strength training is something that I've toyed around with on and off for probably the last 6 years now. I've done a fair bit of work in the gym with a barbell, doing like squats, deadlifts, a couple of the Olympic lifts. And I always found myself getting to the point where I'd plateau in terms of weight, and then I'd hurt myself trying to push beyond that. And when I stepped back and took a look at what you know, why this was the case, it was always my movement patterns that were the issue. So years behind a desk, years on a bicycle, have led to certain movement patterns and stickiness in my body in terms of how it moves. So, you know, I think it was the beginning of last year that I didn't hurt myself, but I kind of tweaked my back, and I was like, you know, I'm just not making any progress here. So I kind of parked it all and didn't get myself in a funk, but I was, you know, kind of looking for something else to do. And I'm a fan of the Tim Ferriss podcast, and he has a wide range of guests on there. And one of the guests was a guy called Chris Sommer, who is a national level gymnastics coach in America. And he's put together, he has his own gym in Denver and Colorado, and he's put together a programming called Gymnastic Bodies. And they kind of went through, you know, what this is and what it entails. And it's basically opening up the training that he does with his, like, elite level gymnast to your average Joe. You know, and I sat, you know, this sounded quite interesting, and it's largely all body weight. training, and they've got an Instagram feed where they show, you know, the progress of their athletes and people who follow the program. And it was, you know, it was amazing to see that there was some guys on there who are, you know, older than ourselves, doing extraordinary things, and it showed where they'd come from. And, you know, my mobility and flexibility is not great, and it used to be really bad. So I kind of, you know, there was a discount on a taster of fundamentals. So I did that, and it was basically the warm up that they do. And I pretty much failed it. You know, I failed warm up, which is, you know, not great for the ego when you can't even, you know, pass go. So I was like, right, I'll give this a bit of a go. So, you know, that's what formed the strength element of what I did. I did add a little bit of kettlebell work in there for kind of some of the explosive stuff. But there's a key element, which is combining strength and mobility and specific stretching routines. And the return that I had of the time invested for just on the stretching stuff was amazing. Just my general life, you know, as we get older, we get like things start to kind of seize up or niggles appear, and so many of them just went away. So it was a real indication that for me, this, I was on the right track, and you know, I was able to get into positions physically with my body that I'd not been able to for a long time. That transferred to the bike. I then added in they do a handstand course. I was like, yeah, man, it'll be cool to do a handstand. And that was quite humbling as well, because I've got nowhere near doing a handstand, because they get start you off doing headstands. But in that, there's a lot of wrist work, because they're not going to get you up on your hands until you've progressed to a certain point where they're confident that your wrists are strong enough to handle your body weight, you know, on your wrist. And that transferred amazingly to mountain biking. So, you know, every time I've been out to the Alps or Finale or Whistler or wherever, I've always ended up with a little bit of arm pump, or, you know, like the death claw grip when you try and take your hand off the handlebar and it doesn't really peel off. And I had zero. I had zero arm pump, zero issue with my hands. My upper body was, you know, not 15-minute runs, no problems. So really, really transferred well to mountain biking. So, and it's something I plan to continue, because it's, you know, you're working towards certain progressions, which there's a goal to your training, as opposed to just, you know, lifting more weight or, you know, doing something similar. It is actually, you're working towards, be it a handstand or a front lever or, you know, a rope climb. It's simply as simple as that.
So that's an online course, yeah, with videos and things like that to help people, yeah, through it.
Yeah, and it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit pricey, but I don't, you know, I can do this at home. Anyone can do it at home. So if you factor in the cost that I don't need a gym membership, you know, it's, and you know, the content is really good, and the follow along stuff is really good. It's for me, it's a well worth investment, because there's so much data out there showing that as we get older, it's harder for us to maintain a certain level of fitness. We lose muscle mass. So anything to counter that will enable us to stay in better shape for longer, stay on two wheels for longer, maybe get faster as we get older for a certain while. So
yeah, that's awesome. We'll dig out a link for that and put it in the show notes over on the website, so people can find it if they're interested. Good stuff. So you sent me a photograph, it was probably January time, of a large green plastic item in your garden. You want to tell us a bit about that?
That's my ice tub. So it's not getting so much use at the moment because it's too warm, but I got into a combination of breathing techniques and ice baths through another guest on the Tim Ferriss podcast. basically the source of all my knowledge these days. And so the breathing technique is a simple way to kind of flush your body with oxygen. And there's it's done by a guy called Wim Hof, who's quite an interesting character, and you can look him up online, and he's done quite a few interesting feats. But I found the cold exposure really kind of beneficial for multiple reasons, really. You know, historically, it's been a way that people have treated a lot of issues. So, you know, well, mental health issues, not that I fall into that category, but they've used it to treat depression. It can fight inflammation. Some people say it increases your lifespan. It has a very positive effect on your nervous system. It really aids recovery. So in the max mileage week that I did, I took an ice bath every, after doing my exercise in the evening, away from the exercise, so it didn't interfere with any kind of muscular improvement that came from the inflammation from the exercise. But I woke up each day feeling really fresh and as if I'd not done anything the day before. It helps with fat loss. It, you know, it improves your sleep. And there's a kind of a mental side to it that's getting in water that's got a thin film of ice on the top for 3 minutes takes a little bit of doing. You know, you've got to, if you can kind of do that, then you can pretty much kind of tackle anything. So yeah, lots of benefits, and you know, I managed to persuade a significant portion of the family to try it, much to everyone's amusement. So yeah, and that combined with the breathing technique was really beneficial for on the breathing side of things. It really helps you control your diaphragm. So, you know, lots of us are guilty of what's called shallow breathing. So we don't really use our lungs to their full capacity. And by purposely breathing in through your nose and providing resistance, you take a longer but deeper breath. And I kind of used this when I was on the Trans Provence and riding not only uphill, making sure I was taking deep breaths, on the downs also to make sure that I didn't kind of shallow breathe and, you know, put too much exertion on my body and lose mental focus. It really meant that I could ride at a pace and continue that pace without getting too out of breath or, you know, too out of touch with what my body was doing.
So that's Wim Hof breathing technique. That's another one, yeah, for people to look up. All right, we'll stick that in the show notes as well. Okay, that's it for part one of our Trans Provence special. Really hope you enjoyed listening. Part two will be available tomorrow. So until then, get out and ride.